with me in a second, so.
Good morning. I'm opening this meeting of the House Committee on Revenue, February 20th. We have a public hearing on two bills, and before I open the hearing on the bills, I'd like to have a little bit of information from Legislative Revenue Office.
Yes, good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. So yeah, I do have just a pretty brief background on the deferral program itself. In the meeting materials, not under any of the bills, just under the meeting materials for the committee, you can see there's nine slides titled Deferral Background. So I'll just be walking through those briefly here. But again, so the two bills that you have in front of you today relate to the Senior Disabled Homestead Property Tax Deferral Program. So I thought I'd just walk through, well, what is the program, who can participate in it, and then I'll finish with a little bit of the financials of the program, how it's been performing over the last decade or so. So in terms of the program, the general way it works is it's about, as the name implies, it's for seniors and disabled individuals, and what they would do is they apply to the Department of Revenue to have their property taxes deferred. So there's an application process through the Department of Revenue, and then the Department of Revenue would then pay the property taxes that are billed by the county each November. So essentially you're just borrowing from the Department of Revenue, and then the counties and the local taxing districts are held harmless because the taxes are paid by the Department of Revenue. When the Department of Revenue, after the application process, Department of Revenue will place a lien on the property. So that does sit there, and DOR becomes a security interest holder in the property. And the lien amount is generally based upon what the expected lifetime borrowing would be for the participant, whether it's the senior or disabled individual. And the balances of accrues, the amount that you actually borrow, accrues at 6% annual simple interest. So that's the cost to the participant, so to speak, of borrowing from the state to pay the county or the local property taxes. So things that trigger a repayment. Again, the deferral participant can leave the program at any time, but there is the option of whether you want to repay or if you just discontinue participating in the program, that balance can sit and accrue interest, but you don't necessarily have to repay all at once. So if there's a reason that a participant may choose to just no longer defer, but they don't have the funds to repay the full balance at that time, that balance can just more or less sit and accrue interest going forward. But things that trigger a repayment would be the deferral participant passing away. There is an option for a survivor, like a surviving spouse, to continue the deferral if they're not already in the program. If the property is sold or transferred, if it's no longer the homestead of the participant, so that's a key requirement there, is this does have to be the home, an owner-occupied residence. This isn't someone who's deferring property taxes on, say, a second home. Or if the property's moved out of the state, that's more for manufactured structure, I suppose. But so at time of death, the way that it would generally work is Department of Revenue would then be repaid the amount of the deferred taxes that have been deferred over the last 5, 10, 15, 20 years, however long the participant's been in the program. And that could be, that also happens when the property's sold. And again, the idea being at that time, there's potentially being able to use the equity in the home or something of that nature to repay that deferred balance.
Yes, Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for this, Kyle. So I just wanted to ask a couple questions about what the amount of the lien is and how the interest gets charged. So the lien, so say you're 65 and you go into this, and the lien would be for the expected amount. There would be some guesstimate about, okay, this person will live 20 years and their taxes are $1,500 this year, they'll go up 3% every year. And so the lien is put on for the whole amount of what is expected to be spent over the year. Okay, so to confirm that. And then number two, the interest then is charged on that whole, on that amount of the whole, the 6% simple, or is it charged at the bit that accumulates each year of the actual money that's being foregone?
Yeah, Representative Smith Warner, it is a simple interest, so it's just going to be the principal. It's not going to be picking up that the compound interest, so to speak. So as the principal grows, that will accrue the interest, but you're not going to be paying the interest on the interest, so to speak.
Okay.
There was a few years where the program was set up as compound interest. That's been removed retroactively as well.
And I had a third question, but I can't remember what it was. So I think those were the most important ones.
Thank you.
Anything else for Mr. Easton before we continue? I'm opening the public hearing on House Bill 2452. We have one person signed up to testify, Mark Garst, Department of Revenue.
And me.
And thank you. Representative Finley, you will begin.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Vice Chair Marsh. For the record, my name is Lynn Finley. I'm from Vail, Oregon, and I'm the state representative for House District 60. I'm here today to urge you support House Bill 2452. As the legislative revenue staff just stated, the Homestead Property Tax Deferral Program was originally created in order to help vulnerable, low-income seniors stay in their homes. In the program, Department of Revenue pays the property taxes and places a lien on the property, which is repaid with interest upon the sale of the property. The problem is, unfortunately, in many rural counties, particularly in eastern and southern Oregon, the county's median real market value is so low, the Department of Revenue is unable to approve applications for what many people would consider a relatively modest home. House Bill 2452 will create a floor of $250,000 for the maximum allowable real market value of a homestead. This would mitigate the problem, ensuring that people who truly need the program will qualify for it. Mr. Gass knows everything about this program. He came to me during the interim, and we talked about this program. So this is something that I think is a really great thing for all of our districts, and he can further explain it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Finley. Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, Mark Garst with the Department of Revenue. So as Kyle laid out, the program works like a loan. If you're qualified for the program, then you're allowed to enter. The 2019 qualification criteria included, but were not limited to being 62 years or older or disabled, having total assets of less than $500,000, which does not include the house, having household income below $44,500, and for the purposes of this bill, RMV, a real market value from the previous year, below a certain threshold. And so I'm sorry for all the numbers. I know this is just cruel to put this up here, but these are the thresholds that currently exist by statute. It's a sliding scale, and the real market value depends on the median value of the homes in your county times a multiplier that's based off of the number of years that you've been in the home. So the maximum allowed real market value in Wheeler, which is the county with the lowest median real market value, their median is about 63,000. So if you've been in your home for 5 to less than 7 years, the home must be worth $62,939 or less in order to qualify for the program. So if you've been in your home 6 years and your home's worth $70,000, we have to tell you no. If you've been in your home for over 25 years, it's 250% of the median value. And so in Wheeler County, that would be $157,347. Anything above that, we have to reject you from the program. Not to pick on Multnomah County, but Multnomah has the highest median real market value right now. And in Multnomah County, if you've been in 5 to 7 years, your home can be worth $402,580 and participate. And if you've been in your home over 25 years, Multnomah just crossed the magic number of over $1 million. So a home that's $1 million, $6,450 is now able to qualify for the deferral program. So there's obviously some logic to this. Homes are more expensive in Multnomah County. So I don't think that anybody's arguing that there should be, you know, shouldn't be some allowance for that. But at the same time, $250,000 is not a tremendous amount of money. And our program folks have, you know, they don't like having to reject people when they come in and apply for what we feel like is a pretty modest home. The bill would create a minimum allowable real market value of $250,000 starting in 2019. And then that figure would be indexed to the CPI. So the result is that in the previous chart that I had up, any place where you saw a number that was less than 250,000, that number would become 250,000. So anybody in any county with a home of $250,000 or less would be able to get into the program. But If the number was above 250,000 on that chart, you would still go to whatever number that was. So in Multnomah County, over 25 years, you'd still be able to get up to just over $1 million. Currently, there are seven counties where there's no home worth 250,000 can qualify, no matter how long folks have been in the program. There are another 13 counties that where folks, depending on how long they've been in the home, will maybe be able to participate where they wouldn't have otherwise. So this will affect 20 counties total. In 2018 season, we rejected 50 applicants for the real market value issue. 19 of these were below 250,000. Now, presumably, there were a lot of people who realized that they weren't going to get into the program because of what their real market value was, and they simply didn't apply. So, so how many people will be able to avail themselves of this? We really can't say. It's a pretty complicated number. We'll defer to LRO. I'm sure that, you know, they'll take their best guess at it. What I will say is that the deferral program is really strong right now. We have a good balance. We're currently running a positive cash flow, which means that we're paying less in taxes than we're taking in repayments every year. So we're seeing our balance grow. And then finally, I'll say that there is a cap on the number of new applicants. So, you know, we've never gotten anywhere near that cap, and I don't think that this change is going to get us anywhere near it. But there is a hard cap in the statutes about how many new applicants there can be. And so we would have some protection along those lines as well from unforeseen circumstances. If there was a mad rush at the program, we would have a couple years easily before there would be any significant issues as far as, you know, it would be many years before we'd be talking about insolvency. But even about changing the fact that we're getting a positive cash flow, it would take some time before we would change that. So the Department of Revenue is supportive of this bill. And again, we really appreciate Representative Finley's work on this.
I'm going to start out with a couple of questions I had. Well, the first is just a point that when you refer to something as a minimum, it's also what I was looking at as a maximum.
Mm-hmm.
So just the language that we're using it could be a bit confusing. The second point I wanted to ask about was the cap. You assured us that we're not close to a cap now, but I'm not anticipating that we're necessarily going to move to a cap quickly, but could you explain to us what happens when you get close to a cap and then you reach the cap? Is it just whoever got there first? Is it done strictly on timing? Who's already in? And then do you start collecting what amounts to a waiting list for people to get into the program once people or properties are taken out of the program? How would that work?
Sure. So Representative Nathanson, the cap's been in place since 2013. It increases every year. Currently it's at 922, and we had 382 new applicants last year. So the cap only applies to new applicants, first of all. And once you get to that cap, it's a somewhat complicated calculation, but my recollection, and I'll definitely correct this if I'm wrong, is that it's basically the further you are away from the county median value, the less likely you are to be accepted. So it's not, I don't think it's first in, first out. It's the people who have effectively homes that are closer to the median get in first, and that's how the cap would operate. But again, obviously, if we got to that cap, we would be coming in and having a conversation with you about that. But we've never gotten anywhere near it. Right now, you know, we have 540. The difference is 540 unused slots, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
So I do not think that this is going to get us there. But you know, we'll wait and see what LRO comes up with.
It's not only subject to the legislature's actions, but also actions that happen in the general economy. Things going on in the state or the region that might impact people's ability to meet their tax obligations.
Chair Nathans, I think that's exactly right. I think that, you know, we've seen participation go down a little bit, but, you know, people who are doing demographics will talk about the silver tsunami. There's a lot of baby boomers coming. I think that they're going to be pretty good when they first retire, but down the road, as they kind of burn through some of that savings, I wouldn't be surprised if we see them. Also, I think the interest rates are a big issue. Our rate is 6%. Right now, you can beat that on a conventional mortgage if you have terrific credit. So, you know, as interest rates rise, we might see more people availing themselves of the program.
Representative Marsh. Thank you, Chair. Mark, could you, is there anything that we should know about the collection rate or the ability to actually recapture these, the money on transition? Were we successful in doing that?
So I did not actually bring up my folder. The next bill deals with collection. I'm sorry, okay. Chair Nathanson, Representative Marsh. The next bill deals with collections. And so we do have an outstanding balance right now where we're still looking to collect. A lot of these, we're just simply waiting for the home to sell, right? One of the prime ways that we get repaid is when the home sells, people want to get that lien released. And so they'll pay us at that time. I've got the number okay. In the back of the room, but I don't want to hip shoot. But, you know, we do have a number of outstanding accounts. I don't know if you have that, Kyle, with you up there. Or total outstanding.
Now, the last time I looked at it was around $140 million, I believe, is the total outstanding. Now,
that's the total of all the liens.
Yeah.
I think we have maybe $10 million, a little less than $10 million in active collections right now. I want to say 500 to 600 accounts. And again, often what we're doing is we're waiting for that home to sell, and that's when we'll collect. Some of these have mortgages. If the mortgage forecloses down the road, then we'll participate in that process. Other times we'll go after or we'll collect from heirs of the property if they, you know, just move into the property, sit there, don't actually transfer it, so there's no way for us to collect on our lien. We have some ability to collect on transferees that way. So we have a lot of collection tools in our toolkit, but there is always a churn, you know, that happens constantly, so.
Yes, thank you. And it would be interesting to know something about the collection costs too. not today, but when you have your folder. Or not this moment, but when you have your
that
folder.
I don't have with me.
Okay.
Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Garst, I was wondering, once you're in the program, are you auto-renewed every year, or do you have to submit an application every year?
Sure. So, Chair Nathanson, Representative Reschke, there's a every two-year process for a recertification, and so we go back and we look at, you know, whether you still meet the criteria of the program, make sure that you haven't moved out of the house, for instance. That was something that the legislature put into effect relatively recently. And I think it's been good at making sure that we have the right people in the program and we're not just letting these kind of carry on just as a matter of course.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you for being here. Thank you for bringing us the bill. Close public hearing on House Bill 2452. Opening a public hearing on House Bill 2460.
So, Madam Chair, House Bill 2460, again, this is relating to the Senior and Disabled Deferral Program, and it's providing that a transferee of a homestead, it would make them not liable for the amounts of the outstanding deferred property taxes that are due on the homestead if that transferee receives no interest in real or personal property from the estate. So this would be following maybe someone, the original deferral participant passing away, and then the person who essentially receives the estate but doesn't receive any interest or any funds from the estate. So the estate is more or less underwater in a lot of cases would be the example. So there's no money in the estate to repay the deferred balance.
Thank you. One person signed up to testify for this bill, Christopher Hamilton.
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, I'm Christopher Hamilton. I'm an attorney here in town with McGinty Belcher and Hamilton Attorneys doing elder law and estate planning. I'm here today representing the elder law section of the Oregon State Bar, who is what brought forward this bill. And we are looking at exactly that situation Mr. Garst commented on of collecting from heirs, but we are looking at a very small I don't know that it's very small, but a subset of that group where the house is underwater and there is nothing else in the estate. And the problem here is the way the statute is currently worded gives at least an argument in favor of letting Department of Revenue go after heirs who have received nothing from the estate and elected to have no involvement in the estate because they are not statutorily required to if there's nothing to be gotten from the estate. The example that caused us to bring this to the legislature's attention was a family where the combination of the mortgage and the outstanding debt to Department of Revenue overwhelmed the value of the house. There was nothing else in the estate. And the heirs did what any good elder law attorney would have advised them to do and simply walked away from the estate and let the creditors deal with whatever foreclosures or other actions needed to be engaged in to collect on their debts. These heirs then received tax warrants from Department of Revenue saying they owed tens of thousands of dollars in taxes on this property that they'd received no benefit from and had elected to walk away from and not engage with based on their deceased relative's decision to engage in the property tax deferral program. And so the intention of the bill is to make it so that in those circumstances, heirs or devisees are not responsible for taxes out of their own pocket when there is nothing to pay them against or pay them out of from the estate. And so these aren't the heirs that Mr. Garst commented on who move into the home and start using it as their residence. These are heirs who completely walked away from the property, left it for foreclosure and being dealt with by creditors, and yet still received tax bills.
Thank you.
And the other piece to know is we are in the middle of a conversation with the Department of Revenue on an amendment for this bill because there were concerns brought up about exactly how the mechanics would work with it as written. So we will likely be coming back with an amendment to the bill. Are there any other questions from the committee?
Just one.
Yes, Representative Rush.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So if the transferee is not liable for outstanding debt, then does the state eat that then? It was just a bad loan? Or what's the remedy, I guess?
Mm-hmm. Chair Nathanson, Representative Reschke, the state essentially ends up with the same remedies that any other creditor on that property had, which is either going to end up being some kind of pro rata share in the foreclosure or having to eat a bad loan if there are superior liens that block them out on that.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Finley?
Thank you, Madam Chair. One question I would have is, and there are cases that this is clearly the right thing to do and a great program, but there are other cases where perhaps it could be gifting for the last few years and the estate has been gifted to heirs and all of their value is gone. And then when they pass away, then there's no value left in the estate or anything. So how do you deal with that?
Chair Nathanson, Representative Finley, that's one of the reasons why we're going into an attempt to amend the statute and come up with a way to address this situation that's a little bit less cut and dry than what is currently in the proposed bill.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. We'll look forward to hearing about an amendment when it's ready. Any other questions? Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll just ask briefly, because you said that about the line of liens, where would this lien fall? Where does a lien from the state fall in the
priority?
Yeah, thank you. In the priority list, I don't know that you have to know that because you do elder law and not real estate law, but in case you do,
Chair Nathanson, Representative Smith Warner, I don't practice real estate or foreclosure law, so it would be an issue where it falls. Of where it falls just in the priority of liens against the house. Typically, that's related to when it was recorded.
Mr. Harris might have an idea to this.
We'll have an additional answer to that question.
Coming forward.
Chair Nathan's the members of the committee. That's exactly right. It's whoever records first has lien priority. But I would just add that typically a mortgage company is not going to allow themselves to be in an inferior position relative to the Department of Revenue. So they will pay off any existing deferral lien, issue the mortgage, and then the person will come back into the deferral program. So as a practical matter, we are almost never above a mortgage holder. We're generally in the later position.
Thank you, Representative Rushkin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Garst, so in the program in total, what percentage are we talking about with this bill? Is it 5%? Is it 2%? Is it 20%? And if you don't know now, then if you could get us that number. So I have an idea, what slice of the pie are we dealing with?
Chair Nathanson, Representative Reschke, so I think that the description of how this has kind of come about was pretty fair. Collection began on transferees. That power was given to us in 2011, amended in 13 and 15. We held off on doing transferee collections until we got this program into our new computer system. We didn't want to do a bunch of work only to have to basically throw it away. So we started in 16. We came out of the gates a little hot, and we were pretty aggressive in how we use this tool. We recognized that there was an issue, and we passed administrative rules at the department to limit the way that we use this collection authority to bring it in line with what we think that the legislature's intent was. And so right now we have 32 open transferee cases, but how many are there out there? We started, we stopped, we reevaluated, and so I'm by no means am saying that that is how many there are. We have 529 deferral accounts that are currently in collections. Any one of those could have an error where we could look for a transferee. The statute has some limitations on when it applies. We look at what the real market value of the home was, less any superior liens. That's the amount we can collect. So, but I'm not trying to discount the bar's position. The real market value is what the tax assessor had on the roll. It may be that the senior could have appealed their property taxes and didn't, so it may not reflect what the property could sell for today necessarily. So it's complicated, but I don't think it's more than 500 today. And when we have, we've only started collection on a fraction of that, so.
Representative Marsh. Thank you. Mark, since you're back up here, I have another question. What would happen if we didn't have this program? How long would counties typically carry someone who simply didn't pay their property tax?
Chair Nathanson, Representative Marsh, I think it takes about 4 years for somebody to go into foreclosure. With the deferral program, if you hadn't paid for a couple of years and you get into the deferral program, we can do what's called a delay of foreclosure. So we don't go back and pay the back years, but the county will not foreclose on you. So the program helps out in that way also. That's about right, is 4 years and you would start to go into the foreclosure process.
One more question. So in that case, is the county superior to the state in terms of collections?
The county tax foreclosures are a little different. They are superior to everyone except for the senior deferral program. We have a special dispensation. We get paid out first on our lien, and then whatever's left over goes to the county. But mortgage holders are not in that situation, and so you're not likely to maybe see those go into tax foreclosure. If the mortgage company can pay it off and foreclose on the property, then they'd be able to recover some assets that way. So,
thanks.
So, and Representative Nathan, if I could just add, I was pretty good on my numbers earlier. 529 cases in collection, combined balance of $9,508,000. 32 open transferee cases right now with a balance of $482,700. So that's about where we're at.
Great, thank you. Any other questions? Thank you. There's nothing else to cover on this bill today. We understand we will look forward to an amendment. I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 2460.
I see nothing else in our business for today. We're adjourned.